Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's new in cars, trucks, and vans this year, and what's on the horizon for car buyers in the near future? The 2011 Dallas Auto Show opens today and continues through this weekend at the Dallas Convention Center. My guest for the hour has already been through the exhibition to check out the highlights and joins us now to talk about it. David Bolt is an automotive journalist who writes for Autotrader.com and KBB.com. Dave, welcome back to Think.
Well, thank you, Chris. Very good to be here.
Are Americans ready to buy new cars again?
I believe they are, and everything from a sales standpoint indicates that they've got that willingness. We think banks are cooperating with the concept, and that probably is the key factor, but a combination of a better economy or a perceived better economy, an increased attention to fuel efficiency. And bottom line, over a three-year period, the fleet has just gotten older. So people that could drive their cars for another year or 2 years, well, those 2 years are behind them. And I think we're all getting itchy, whether it's from a desirability standpoint or just a basic need.
So fuel efficiency has changed a lot since the last time you were here, which is like 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. Now there's hybrid options, there's different kinds of hybrid batteries, and there's electric cars finally on the market. What excites you this year?
Well, I think the fact that we've got all those variations is exciting. As I'm filling up my wife's Grand Cherokee, and we love the Grand Cherokee, but as I'm filling it up at $4 a gallon, it's become a $60, $65 fill-up rather than a $50
fill-up. That's a big chunk.
It is a big chunk. And we don't drive that much, so it doesn't impact us that much. But that said, I think both psychologically and on a month-in, month-out basis, those bills add up, and you start paying attention to both your driving habits and what you're filling up. 40 miles per gallon is the new 30 miles per gallon. So for all intents and purposes, economy has now got a different number attached to it, and they're increasing number of conventional drivetrains that get 40. Ford's Focus, Chevy's Cruze are two examples. And then, of course, the alternatives. EPAs vary based on city and highway driving, but typically your hybrids are getting a 40 mile per gallon combined average.
So does that mean combined average for you and me, the consumers? Because sometimes what you see on the sticker seems to be really different than what happens on the road.
Well, conventional hybrids like a Prius are better in stop-and-go driving. They're more efficient there and less efficient on the highway. Still very efficient, but that's not where you're maximizing their benefit. So typically, the Prius is a better, if I do a lot of stop-and-go driving, that's the better purchase. If you're doing a lot of freeway driving, some of these conventional drivetrains that I mentioned, the four-cylinder Cruze, which has a 1.4 liter with turbo, very small when you don't need the power, and yet so it's very efficient when you're not using the power. But then when you boost it up, as it were, you get the performance that you need for modern-day driving. So you really ought to take a look at your real needs and base an automotive decision on those, if at all possible. Emotion ought to come into it a little bit also.
I think it always does, no matter what. What about, you know, talking about actual needs and the way you drive in terms of these cars that we're plugging in now? Because some of them have a range of about 100 miles, right, and then that's it.
Well, the Nissan Leaf, and again, I kind of look at my own driving. My wife has a 35-mile round-trip commute. That would give her 2 days of all-electric driving before she plugs it in the following night. That, to my way of thinking, would be perfect for our purposes. Another thing about the all-electric or the Chevy Volt, which is an electric with gas assist, they're really competent cars, and that probably is where I was most skeptical. Okay, they've got the novelty of these all-electric or almost all-electric drivetrains, but are they good cars?
Yeah.
And from all appearances, they're excellent cars. The Leaf has some design details that you just wouldn't believe for that price point, and the Volt is almost like a sports sedan, genuinely fun to drive. And in that instance, I think the number is something on the order of 75 miles of all-electric potential, but then you've got this gas generator that will kick in and enough gas in the tank to drive another 300 miles before filling up that tank. So it could be your day-in, day-out electric, and then if you have a weekend destination that you want to make, like Austin, you've got that one car that could also get you to Austin without recharging.
What about the bigger hybrids? Because they're available, but their mileage is not so much better than if you just settled for a slightly smaller car that had a conventional drivetrain.
I think for all intents and purposes, that's a combination of marketing and engineers putting their foot in the water. I'm thinking of a Cadillac Escalade. It's a beautiful big SUV. There was another adjective there that I'll leave off. But anyway, beautiful SUV, but it's $92,000, and the mile per gallon increment is just very incremental.
Right.
So I'm not understanding the math in that unless you just want to be a little more eco-friendly from both a perception standpoint and your own perception standpoint.
So it's a style thing at that point?
I think there may be a fashion aspect to a $92,000 Escalade. and since I'm not in that demographic, that fashion aspect escapes me. But GM has also done something on a pickup line. Mm-hmm. And the beauty of the auxiliary electricity on board that pickup was you could use power tools off of it.
Hmm.
That's kind of neat for a contractor. But again, it was like 10% of mile per gallon improvement. And in the truck category, Ford has been very strong, and other domestics with their new V6 powertrains. Mm-hmm. They're reintroducing the V6 concept to a pickup truck and getting genuinely significant improvements in the economy based on that V6 technology.
They've been V8s previously?
They've been, well, V8s have been kind of the button on which people buy pickups.
Uh-huh.
And to be sure, the V8s are getting more efficient, but the fact that they've got a new family of V6s in virtually all of the truck lineups that are built by the domestics bodes well for efficient driving while you still have to go to work or use your truck for something.
Mm-hmm. What about family cars? Because for a while, you had to have an SUV or what we call crossovers.
Mm-hmm.
And minivans were like, I don't know, there's a lot of parents out there who don't pride themselves in being so cool, but somehow they were too cool for minivans. But that's changing.
It is. The perception of minivan is changing. And frankly, I think the reality is changing. People are waking up to the fact, whether it's efficiency or just general packaging, they're waking up, or maybe it's the aging consumer, but they're waking up to the fact that minivans are hugely easy to get into and out of.
Mm-hmm.
They're very easy to pilot. And your mini average size minivan has far more usable accommodation than your biggest SUV. And the range of minivans is also getting wider. Ford on their stand has a new Focus-based C-Max that will be out next fall. One of the best values at the show was Mazda's Mazda 5, which is a mini minivan.
Three rows of two, right?
Three rows of two. The third row, admittedly, is just for kids, mm-hmm. and they should be small kids. But still, in a pinch, you can accommodate six people safely. And you can do that at a price point of between $22,000 and $25,000. $1,000, and you can get upwards of 27, 28 miles per gallon out of it. So, I mean, just a huge amount of practicality, and the platforms are genuinely fun to drive in relative terms.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do they
stuff.
Look better than they used to?
I think the Odyssey has actually gotten a little bit of an edge to the styling.
Mm-hmm.
This Focus C-Max, you would swear you were in Paris or Berlin, mm-hmm. as you view it, because it's very European in its profile. Mazda is has a little bit of a funk factor, and I think people have awakened to the fact that a little bit of funk for 60 months isn't necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah, people can live with it for now.
Right, right.
Let's talk about high-end cars, because what's always interesting to me is watching the really cool features that are in, you know, Jaguars sort of work their way down into the Hondas and Hyundais of the world.
Very much so.
What are we seeing right now that maybe will make its way into mid-price cars later on?
Well, I think first and foremost, because I'm a driving guy rather than an electronic guy, that
mm-hmm.
may be generational, it may be interest, but I think the dynamics of more expensive cars continue to trickle down.
Mm-hmm.
The better braking, the better steering, the better safety features that are the active safety features, the ability to avoid an accident in the first place.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the passive safety technology, electronic force brake distribution, which prevents you from hitting the guy in front of you
mm-hmm.
in a panic stop in a more controlled fashion than you would otherwise. All of that's trickling down. The technology, absolutely. I mean, it's like your laptop computer. Everything becomes more accessible with time. And I'd be hard-pressed to point to specific examples of that. Rear-view cameras is certainly one. The connectivity. Ford, I think, my God, you go in and buy a pull-type wagon at a Ford dealership, and I swear it's going to have the MySync Apple-type applications.
Yeah.
So all of that's coming down. But I would point to the dynamics of automobiles. They're all getting better, and all of that's getting better at lower price points.
I have to say, I was looking online at the Hyundai. Is it Veloster? I don't even know how you say that.
Yeah, I don't either. But Velostar?
Yeah, maybe that's it.
No, Veloster. Veloster. Thank you.
But they were talking about their connectivity, and they had an Xbox console in the dashboard. And I got to tell you, Dave, I think that's a bad idea.
And I'm with you. This distracted driving aspect, in most presentations anymore, they're almost talking as if they're at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas as opposed to an auto show. And the distracted driving, obviously we know what that is. And I just think that they're cars. And when you get back to your cubicle or get back to your home office, that's when you ought to plug in and
your
connect.
Xbox.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So I'm not buying into it at all. And it'll be interesting to see how it evolves before it starts getting legislated
mm-hmm.
more aggressively than it already is.
Did the luxury car market take a big hit when the economy tanked?
I'm afraid. Well, I guess because I'm not in the luxury car market, I shouldn't say I'm afraid not. But no, the luxury car market was impacted, but not like everyone else was impacted. We went from, in the U.S., a 17 million car a year annual market to about a 10 million, so roughly 40% down. Mm-hmm. I think most of the luxury was maybe impacted by half of that. So there was a struggle, but not nearly to the extent that it was among the mainstream car makers.
So people would keep their Mercedes an extra year rather than trading down to a Camry or something.
And also a great deal of that business is lease business. Mm-hmm. And I think lease prospects with their better income and typically better credit rating are less impacted in a downturn than the average consumer is. So those people could continue leasing their E-Class in a manner that Joe Smith can't buy his $20,000 Malibu.
What do you think about the concept cars that are at the show this year? What are the most interesting ones to you?
Dallas is always a little bit light in the concept category, and that doesn't take anything away from the show. It's just that it's not a Detroit or a Los Angeles or a New York.
Right.
So, but in terms of concepts that kind of speak to me, GMC has a model called the High Terrain. At least I know it's GM. Mm-hmm. I think it's GMC. But that is a go-anywhere type truck. It's kind of inspired by Ford's Raptor, which is already in production.
Uh-huh.
But you know, if you like trucks and you want to go anywhere, if you want to cross a desert, GMC's High Terrain can do that. Chevrolet brought the Corvette Stingray concept, which is very much a concept. It won't be produced in this form, but at least hints at the next generation of Corvette. So obviously, if you're a Corvette enthusiast wanting to know what you're going to buy next, this will at least give you some cues as to the direction they're going. And beyond that, I would say the production stuff, much of which was concepts at one time, but the production stuff is probably of more interest because it's there on the showroom right now.
Do they use some of those concepts as ways to, you know, without guaranteeing that they'll produce these things, mm-hmm. as ways to sort of test the pulse of the market?
Very much so. A combination of two things. Concept is typically built if you don't have anything else to talk about, mm-hmm. and that happens if you're in a mid-product cycle or at a specific show, a big show, where you want to get the media's attention but don't have a production announcement to make, then you build a concept. And then obviously, or maybe not so obviously, there are some aspects of concept media testing, marketing testing, that they can apply in the design studio itself. So it's an expensive process. Those things cost hundreds of thousands of dollars typically to build, but there's a real payback both in media attention paid and consumer feedback that they can get.
Do you know what happens after an auto show? Do, 30% more people show up at their local dealerships the following weekend and test drive things?
You've got a recreational shopper who's there, like I often have been, just mm-hmm. because they have an enthusiasm for the product and want to see what's new. But you also have people typically within 6 months of their purchase. Mm-hmm. And the thing I've always said about auto shows, there's absolutely no better way of comparison shopping in a nice, civilized environment, unless you go there on Saturday night.
Yeah.
but on a nice, civilized environment, go from Mazda to Honda to Toyota, Chevy to Ford to Chrysler, all of that, in a 15, 20-minute walk.
Yeah.
And you can sit down, see what you like. Sure, you can't drive them, but you can narrow the field just based on how it's going to accommodate you and your needs from the most important position of the car, which is the steering wheel and driver's seat.
Mm-hmm. And no pressure to buy anything.
That's correct, right. Mm-hmm. Although, that said, I also think there are sales tactics that remain out there from 1967, but for the most part, showrooms have gotten a great deal more civilized because they've got what they call a consumer satisfaction aspect to them, and those people don't want to be perceived as being the arm twisters that they used to be.
Automotive journalist David Bolt is my guest. We're speaking about highlights and trends from the 2011 Dallas Auto Show, which is going on through this weekend at the Dallas Convention Center. If you'd like to join this conversation, you can get on the line now. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is automotive journalist David Bolt. He's speaking this hour about highlights and trends from the 2011 Dallas Auto Show going on through this weekend at the Dallas Convention Center. You can join us right now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's speak on the phones now to Lisa in Fort Worth. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. I guess going back about 6 years ago, I was saving up for an F-250 because I haul a horse trailer. And with the price of gas going up, I made the decision to get an old truck and to buy a Miata and have fun in a convertible sometimes. And really liked that decision. Fast forward, I had a child, sold the Miata, and scaled down to an F-150. And now she's going on 5 years old, and price of gas is going back up, and I'm kind of springtime. I'm trying to eye convertibles again and thinking of going back to my old strategy, and was wondering what the I'm thinking very strongly about a Mini Cooper, and I was wondering what the safety factor is as far as a Mini Cooper goes and hauling a child around.
Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for your call.
And great question, Lisa. And I'm a big fan of the Mini Cooper convertible. Mini is owned by BMW. So from a structural standpoint, admittedly, when you take the top off of anything, you've obviously lost a component of your structure because you no longer have a top. But that said, BMW and Mini have an engineering partnership that works very, very well. And I think I could suggest without any reservation whatsoever that a Mini convertible would be a nice choice for you to make.
They're such adorable cars, too.
They are adorable cars. Although I sometimes think cuteness can be wearing occasionally. But how soon are you making the decision, Lisa?
When do you think you're going to buy?
Price of gas going up could be pretty soon.
Well, I just wanted to suggest one other thing. If you like the Mini convertible, I think it's 6 months to 8 months. Fiat is just returning to the U.S. showrooms with the Fiat 500. And they're going to have a cabriolet, but it keeps the B and C pillars. In other words, it keeps the basic structure of the coupe. And then you have a canvas top that rolls all the way back. So you essentially have most of the benefits of a true convertible while keeping that rollover integrity of the coupe. Anyway, I know Fiat has some information on its U.S. website. If it doesn't, go to Fiat Italy or whatever, and you can see an image of their cabriolet. But I think it's available in the next 6 to 8 months in the U.S.
How are Fiats doing these days in terms of repair costs?
We understand, and they're going to back it up with a great warranty. Mm-hmm. But we understand that in Europe, it's a sea change mm-hmm. with respect to what it used to be in the U.S. I was a Fiat owner back in the day.
And so you know what I'm talking about?
Well, my perception, frankly, was that it was as much of a dealer issue. If you don't have a good dealer network, uh-huh. I don't know that Fiat built a car that was any less reliable than a VW was at that point in time. Yet VW had this great dealer network and Fiat had virtually no dealer network. So they suggest that the dynamic has changed both in terms of the car itself and what they're going to back it up with. That said, it's a brand new model in the U.S. fleet. And I think consumers are going to have to vote themselves or provide feedback themselves as to how well they do. But there's no reason to believe that it will be a problematic car based on what we've seen so far.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jim in Fort Worth. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. Just a quick comment or two here. The simple fact that General Motors is, you know, easily a half century old. They're what, a half-trillion-dollar company. And they come around and they tell us year after year they just can't build gasoline-powered engine that gets better than 30, 35 miles per gallon. When are they going to start building 80-mile-per-gallon engines like we know they can? You know, I understand that they've got hundreds of millions of dollars invested in cast-iron engine blocks and water pumps and whatnot, but let's get real. This is the 21st century. They are embarrassing themselves by lying to us and say they can't do it because it's perfectly clear from the technology that they should be able to.
What do you think, Dave?
Well, I think GM has changed considerably in the last 2-3 years. If anything can wake you up, it's a government bailout through bankruptcy. So while I wouldn't disagree that the lineage from them has been ongoing and kind of pushing back because they can sell big SUVs and trucks and make a lot of money doing so, historically, their small cars have never been particularly efficient, nor have they been particularly good. But I think we're seeing with the Chevy Cruze, with what will be the Sonic in 2012, which is a sub-subcompact, and with their approach on the Volt, which is the electric car with gasoline assist, the ratings on that type of car, EPA-wise, is it's weird science, but I drove a Volt for something like 80, 90 miles in Austin a couple months back. Mm-hmm. And I think we burnt all of like half a gallon of gas in that process. In other words, we were on the electric battery for most of it, and only at the very end of that battery cycle did the gasoline engine kick in. So if you're just going 80 miles, I can assure him that you can go do that on less than a gallon of gas. Going forward, it's going to be an even greater sea change in the next 5 years because of government mandates for a better economy and the realization that people will drive smaller cars if it saves them some real money in doing so.
Are we getting to the place where it doesn't cost a huge premium to buy an electric or hybrid car?
With government incentives, it doesn't. The Volt is about a $45,000 transaction, but there's something like $7,500 to $10,000, depending upon where you live, federal and state.
So it sort of shifts that price.
It moves it down to $35,000, at which point more people can access it. Obviously, $35,000 is still a lot of money. The Leaf, which is the all-electric with a 100-mile range from Nissan, that's about a $33,000 window sticker, less the credits, so it becomes a $20,000 to $25,000 transaction. And I promise you, those are very, very nice cars at those price points after the credits.
Mm-hmm. So they feel pretty nice inside as well.
The Leaf still has a little bit of the Econobox to its plastics, but it has enough to offset that. And again, it's a full $10,000 less expensive than the Volt. The Volt is pretty well dressed up. It's kind of ready to go out to dinner, if you will.
We have an email here from David in Dallas who wants to know if Saab is at the auto show and what do they have?
Good question. We're pulling for Saab. I noticed a Saab is owned by one of your special employees on the parking lot. Mm-hmm. And Saab's on the rebound. But I don't believe, I think I'm correct in saying they're not at the show, but I'd certainly advise going to Dallas Auto Show's website and confirming that. They're on the rebound. They've been financially saved by a very, very small maker of hyper-exotic cars called Spyker. And at this point, Saab is a work in progress, both from a design standpoint and a financial standpoint. But they've got a very unique character in their design. It's a very clean Scandinavian take on automotive design. And I know a lot of enthusiasts are pulling for their successful return. But I can't answer if they're at the show.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Sue in Dallas. Hi, Sue.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Hello, and thank you for taking my phone call, first of all. My question is a two-part question. I am interested in finding out if your guest knows when we will have pickup trucks that they are hybrid pickup trucks. And also the other question I had was about converting the current pickup trucks to use diesel. And what's the cost on that?
The second question first. There are diesel trucks, but they're of the heavy-duty category. So while they do provide better efficiency than a big gas engine in that segment, towing, hauling heavy loads, that sort of thing, you don't buy them for their efficiency. I love the idea of a light-duty diesel, and it baffles me as to why we don't have them in the U.S. They just make so much sense to be able to get a pickup's utility and get 30 miles per gallon. And a light-duty diesel, one that doesn't have to carry heavy loads or tow heavy things, but just get you around in like an F-150 would. So I'm not sure when that's coming. Ford took a hard look at light-duty diesels, but at this point I don't see anything on the calendar, nor do I think it would be a practical investment to convert an existing truck to that. You'd spend far more in the conversion than you'll ever spend on fuel. You'll forgive me. The first question?
Hybrid pickup trucks.
It's going to happen. This mild hybrid has been tried. In terms of a hybrid that gets that 35 miles per gallon, it is going to happen, but I don't know of any product announcements to that effect.
Is that because that market, the first priority has not been fuel efficiency?
Pretty much, yeah. I think they're looking for the target consumer first, and unless there are a lot of hand raisers to suggest that. And again, $4 a gallon creates a dynamic that $3 a gallon never would. And the realization that security in the Mideast costs us ever more dollars than it ever did suggests that there ought to be more hand raisers to that notion.
I will probably never drive a fancy or sporty car, but what do you see in the sports car market that interests you?
Well, if it was Lisa that was the Miata owner, it's amazing that that car now has been here since 1990. They sold 900,000 of them, and it remains about as compelling as it did at first blush. It's just an amazing amount of fun for a $25,000 investment. But sports cars are taking different forms. I would point to Nissan's Juke. It's a four-door kind of quasi-crossover that has about the edgiest sheet metal of anything on the auto show. Sells for between $19,000 and about $24,000. Is available with all-wheel drive, but not an off-road boulder-hopping all-wheel drive, just an all-season all-wheel drive.
When you say sheet metal, is this the one with the really sculptural sides
yes,
to it?
Yes, very much so. And a front end in which the headlights basically just kind of pop out like a frog's.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, it is a love-it-or-hate-it styling exercise, but a huge amount of fun to drive. And just speaks, you touched on the Hyundai and the Veloster, or however we've decided to pronounce it. Those, again, are Scion has been big with respect to tapping into a youth market that wants something that's fun to drive but also just fun to be in.
Mm-hmm.
And for those reasons, I think there's just a lot going on in the sports car or sporty car segment that is different from what it used to be. That said, classic traditionalists who just want a drop top and something to be seen in, Camaro's convertible is now out and is at the show. I think it's on showrooms, but certainly at the show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still a classic way of just getting down a boulevard on a nice evening. And Dallas has a lot of those for a reasonable investment, probably $32,000 to about $42,000.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next to South Lake and speak with Jim. Hi, Jim.
Hey, yeah, I've got a question about Volkswagen. I wanted to know what's up with them. I have an 03 Passat and a 07 Bug, a Beetle with the convertible top for my kids. And although I love the cars engineering-wise, I love to drive them, they just don't – it seems like I'm always taking them to the shop. And lately when I've had the Bug in a couple times already this year, you know, to have work done, I get the loaner cars, and it seems like the new ones, I think it was their smaller Passat, what's it called? The
Jetta?
Yeah, the Jetta. It just seems like they've cheapened it up a little bit, and I just wondered if you have any opinions or any inside track on what Volkswagen's up to.
Well, as an auto writer, Jim, we always have opinions. We just look for someone to pay us for them. But thanks for the question. And as background, Volkswagen is pursuing a volume strategy both in the U.S. and globally. And to get that volume, they think they need to provide lower price points and just about go with a value strategy mm-hmm. in their volume segments. So a Jetta, to Jim's point, is more like a Corolla in price point, but it's also like more like a Corolla in execution. And there's nothing wrong with Toyota's Corolla. It's a great product. But it is not what people buy VWs for.
Right.
And so my perception is that you're going to have to shop a VW showroom very selectively for the VWs that are marketed to Europeans like a GTI is, or the ones that are marketed to the U.S. consumer, which regrettably is what the Jetta and the Passat are transforming to. Reliability issues, they've been there. And the good news is Volkswagen knows it. And they argue they're making a very strong effort to correct them. But historically, the ownership process of a Volkswagen has been more expensive than of a competitive Japanese make.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we will go to Jaspreet in Dallas. Hi, Jaspreet.
Hey, Jim, actually, hit on this really quick. I'm also a Volkswagen owner. And along a very similar line. With the new 2012 Jetta, they switched to, again, like I said, a much cheaper price point. And I just drove one recently, and it seemed like, you know, it had a supercharger from the 90s where it had a very slow, acceleration. And then finally when it got to speed, it was a very happy car. But with the cheaper Jettas and the cheaper Passat, I think the new Passat is starting off at something crazy like $18,000. It seems like the CC, which is a nice car, but not something I would pay $35,000 for a Volkswagen from, Their vision seems to be lost, and I don't think I've had two Jettas. I love Jettas. I'm a young male, and I just don't understand why they're going this route when they're going to lose their current base, and I don't know if they're going to succeed in getting the, you know, to be the, I believe the CEO said he wanted to be the number three or number two car maker by 2020 or 2018.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly it. I would still argue a four-door GTI, which is a German car designed for Germans to enjoy is one of the nicest $25,000 purchases you could make. But I'm all about what you're saying with regard to Passat and Jetta. The Koreans, especially Kia, are, I think, kind of dialing into that driving dynamic and architecture. Kia's stylist was at one time at Audi. So I think the Koreans may start building more Germanic cars than VW is at the current time. And the nice thing about America, it's a competitive segment. And you've got a lot of new choices each and every year.
What determines when the automakers decide to produce specific models only in Europe or only in Asia or in the U.S.?
I think it's a dated philosophy at this point in time. Ford is making a big deal and is delivering in most cases with their one Ford model. We're not going to offer a Focus for Europe that's a great car and then dumb it down for the U.S. because the U.S. market won't pay a lot for a small car.
Right.
Many, for all intents and purposes, transformed that business model. People are paying $25,000, $35,000 for a Mini because it's well-constructed and well-designed and fun to drive. And so, thankfully, others are paying attention to that phenomenon. And Focus today on a Ford showroom is, I think, 99% of what it is on a European showroom and speaks very nicely to the better finish and the better driving dynamic that Europeans have typically enjoyed. It's also now closer to a $20,000 transaction mm-hmm. than it was previously.
And I guess Americans maybe are finally coming around to the idea that with fuel prices such as they mm-hmm. are and with the concerns about fossil fuels, we need to think about at least considering smaller cars.
Right, right. And your environment, I mean, we as individuals typically only need so much space.
Right.
If it's one or two people in the car most of the time, you want that space nicely finished out, but you don't need more space.
Mm-hmm.
So drive what you need and rent what you don't.
David Bolt is my guest. He is an automotive journalist who writes for KBB, excuse me, thank you, and autotrader.com. I'm just stuck on my tongue there. He's talking about the highlights and trends from the 2011 Dallas Auto Show going on through this weekend at the Dallas Convention Center. You can find information about the show online. There's a link on the Think page of KERA.org. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@KERA.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, an evening graduate program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is David Bolt, an automotive journalist who writes for Autotrader.com and KBB.com. He is in town for this weekend's Dallas Auto Show, which continues at the Dallas Convention Center through Sunday. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next on the line to Andrew in Dallas. Hey, Andrew.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I drive an O2 Accord. It's got about 115,000 miles on it. And last December, I was all excited because I was going to buy an Audi A6. And that's when I learned that they were coming out with the new body style and, you know, all the new features that come with that. And so I guess my question is, am I well advised to have waited? I know they're going to deliver, I think, May or June. And then I don't know if you can answer to this, but the one thing about owning this Honda all these years is it's never dawned on me that I'd have a problem other than replacing brake pads and timing belt and kind of things like that. I'm curious to know if an Audi's going to stand the test of time like my Honda is.
I would argue Audi builds a beautifully executed car. And from what I understand of the A6, I've not been in one, have seen them at auto shows, but I understand it's going to be a very, very nice update of an existing model. One that's very, very important to Audi's business. Audi is knocking them dead from a sales standpoint, mm-hmm. but they still haven't cultivated that mainstream sedan audience that the A6 represents. So it's a very important car. That said, an Audi, while enjoying better reliability than a Volkswagen, Audi does not have the reputation that the previous callers alluded to with regard to servicing issues. But it is still a more complex mechanism than an Accord is going to be and will always be a more complex mechanism. I would tend to shy away from a lot of the electronic add-ons or options in an Audi purchase if I could, if I truly wanted to own one for that 8 to 10-year cycle that you seem to own cars. Finally, just get an extended warranty on as much of the car as you can and go forward and enjoy the ownership process. They're beautiful cars, beautiful driving dynamics, and very, very well executed. But I would not approach them as I would a Honda in its purchase. And having said that, let me just throw this out at you. Acura with the TL has a driving dynamic that's very European and has an ownership history that is very Honda because it's a Honda byproduct. So that might be an idea.
What's up with Lexus these days?
They're doing fine. Mm-hmm. I think there may be a little bit of a search for direction from a branding standpoint at mm-hmm. this point. But And also, you've got an aging product to an extent that you might not have had 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But they continue selling very, very well. They don't generate the buzz, mm-hmm. because they've never tried to. But a BMW or a new Mercedes model, those introductions generate real excitement. Lexus just goes quietly about its business, doesn't draw a lot of attention to itself, but it has an ownership body that is very, very happy. You folks are raffling that CT200H.
Yes, I have nothing to do with that.
And
but
I understand, different
it's
department.
It's a pretty car.
But it is. Mm-hmm. And it's, I guess, for the Prius prospects that would like to do business at a Lexus dealership. And there's not a bad idea, really.
Yeah. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next to Paul in Ferris. Hi, Paul.
Yes. In 2001, I went to Korea, and we borrowed a car from a friend, and it ran on liquid propane gas, LPG.
Mm-hmm.
And they had filling stations all over the country there, so we could drive around and fill up. And I was wondering how come none of that has, you know, technology or whatever. I mean, it was the same model car as the gas-powered cars, but they had liquid propane, and why there's none in America yet, or have they looked into that?
Is that about infrastructure?
It is, as much as anything. Honda, I think, has been as aggressive as anyone in putting a fleet out of liquid propane or liquefied propane cars. But again, it's where you get them fueled. Mm-hmm. And that is, as much as anything, going to inhibit the transition to electric vehicles or full electric vehicles. For people that do a lot of driving, where do you get them charged? Other than your own garage.
What does that do to your electric bill, by the way?
Apparently, the key is, and Texas, as I perceive it, has high electric rates.
Mm-hmm. We all perceive it that way.
Right. But I think the key is to have it programmed whereby you can recharge on low cycles. In other words,
overnight, between
midnight
and 6 a.m.
Right. And mm-hmm. by virtue of that, the hope is that you benefit from a better rate structure when you're doing so.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Here's another email. This one from Donna, who writes, if you drive only approximately $4,000, 4,000 miles a year, is it worth it to consider the higher cost of a hybrid?
It's not. Mm-hmm. No. I hope you enjoy your car. I would try and bicycle 4,000 miles a year.
Yeah, if you're that close, maybe.
That's right.
Let's go back to the phones. This time we will go to Efren in Louisville. Hi, Efren.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a 2003 G35 that's great at $237,000, and I was interested if Nissan is developing. I'd read they're developing their own hybrid, maybe coming out in some kind of M35 or something. I was wondering if you knew anything about that.
I think it's out, or it's on the cusp of being out. And I can tell you that, Nissan initially adapted some Toyota technology, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that in hybrid production. The Altima hybrid, I believe, uses Toyota technology. Nissan was working on its own, and absolutely no reason they're not capable of doing that. I have heard very good things about the M35, and I can only imagine that the hybrid variant of it would be a very, very nice car.
Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Cindy in Arlington. Hey, Cindy.
Hi, Chris. Let me say first that your show is the reason we are friends members of KERA.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate that.
I have daughters who will be driving next year, and my husband is inclined to get them a Suburban or a Hummer or a double cab pickup.
Something gigantic.
And my question is there any car that you can recommend that's not quite so monstrous that would still be safe were it in an accident with such a huge car?
I'm hard-pressed, and thank you again for being a friend of KERA. But I'm hard-pressed to suggest a Suburban or a monster truck for a teenager. What I would suggest is that most late model cars have both active safety, your ability to avoid an accident, and passive safety, their ability to survive the accident, far better than even 10 years ago. So if you're buying a late model anything, I think you can be assured that they're in a cocoon that's appropriate to a parent and their offspring. My daughter, and this is 10 years ago, but she started driving in a Civic hatchback. Good visibility, decent proportions, smallish footprint, but not a tiny footprint, and seemed to have done very, very well in that. As a college student, we had her in a Mazda 3.5 door, and again, good visibility, reasonable footprint, and in that case, a far better body structure. In fact, Mazda shares its basic architecture with smaller Volvos in that particular model line. So if you're looking for something, that might be a pretty good, compelling combination.
When you talk about visibility, you mean like how the windows are structured and that sort of thing?
Sight lines, mm-hmm. forward to the sides, and with a new driver, the ability to turn around.
Yeah.
Not everything comes with an electronic assist, a mm-hmm. rear view camera. And to my way of thinking, first and foremost is visibility, especially in urban environments. You see all these super exotics, the $300,000 cars with 200-mile-an-hour capability. They're hellish in town because you can't see out of them. Mm-hmm. You have no idea what's around you. You could get around town in a GTI far better. And that's another example of a very solid structure in a reasonably sized platform. I'd go with something like that.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Blake in Dallas. Hey, Blake.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for putting on another wonderful show day after day and for a great show today.
Thank you.
I'm curious from your guest. I'm looking, my dream car has always been a BMW, and I'm a young man getting to the age where I can finally afford a BMW. And I was wondering if it's better to purchase new, or if it's better to purchase used, given the depreciation value driving off the lot. I understand they're very well manufactured cars, and
so you're thinking a couple of years old, is that what you'd consider if you bought a used one?
I'm looking at a 2008 328 XI with 16,000 miles on it.
All right, what do you think, Dave?
I think that'd be a great buy. And it doesn't have to be in the certified pre-owned category. In other words, if you're buying it from a private individual, that would be fine too. But Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Audi all have certified pre-owned programs that can save you a chunk of change and still give you the security of inevitably a complete inspection of the vehicle prior to it being put on retail and a warranty that's appropriate to buying a car that's a couple years old. Mm-hmm. You benefit from the remainder of the factory warranty, which on a 2008 should still be there, but they'll probably extend the warranty also. And if you can save over 2 years 30% on a $40,000 window sticker, that is a significant savings.
And it still looks brand new when you drive it home.
Yeah, and in some instances, I've personally prefer the previous Gen 3 series to the one that's on showrooms now. I would love to be in a position where I could go shopping for a 2006 3 series and get the benefit of a nice ownership experience at far less money.
Is it
so
hard
it's a good idea.
Is it hard for you to decide what kind of car you and your wife will own when you get to drive new ones all the time?
Well, my wife has like an 8-10-year ownership process, so we don't do that often.
Uh-huh.
And she's, as I mentioned, likes Jeeps, so uh-huh. we've kind of been there. For me, I frankly kind of get what the family isn't driving.
Right.
I do benefit from press cars periodically, mm-hmm. but I typically we hand off cars and then I'll get whatever the kid is tired of driving.
So you're not picky?
Not particularly. Mm-hmm. I love cars, but I find it as confusing as anyone to actually go out and pull the trigger because there is so much variety and most of it is genuinely good.
That somehow comforts me.
Yeah, really. You are hard-pressed to make a bad choice in today's automotive environment.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Roy in Fort Worth. Hi, Roy.
Hi. I got a comment, really, and a very question that maybe can help settle a discussion the wife and I are having. The comment is, I wish American car manufacturers would make an affordable, economic car, a Kia, which leads into my question, and that is, I can tell the wife that if we get rid of the V8 Durango and buy a little Kia, gets about 30 miles to the gallon, just from the savings on the gas, we'll be able to we'll be able to afford to make the car payment. Is that a good argument, or am I just fantasizing?
No, no. If the math works, it certainly is a good argument. I have no idea how much you're driving. Sometimes, though, we overstate savings. You know, if you're driving something that gets 20 miles per gallon and you're looking to spend $15,000 to upgrade to 30 miles per gallon, please do the math. 15,000 miles a year at 30 miles per gallon is 500 gallons of fuel. At 20 miles per gallon, it's 750 gallons. That's $1,000 difference. Over 12 months, $80 a month. In other words, you really want to go out on a limb financially to save that $80 a month. But with your math, it may be different. So a Durango to a subcompact is quite a transition, but a great many people are making it. I would argue try and transition into something maybe more midsize with 30 miles per gallon and make sure that you're comfortable with the decision before you commit 60 payments to it.
Years ago, when we first had the Prius coming out and the Civic Hybrid, there were questions about what the long-term resale value would be and how it would compare with conventional vehicles. What have we learned about that?
It's been as good as, and in fuel spikes like we have right now, it's absolutely golden. Mm-hmm. But the cars have been reliable. The battery packs are long-lived. I think, I'm not sure of this, but I think they have 100,000-mile warranties typically on the battery pack itself, and there have been absolutely no problem issues whatsoever. And while they're more complicated than a conventional drivetrain, it's not rocket science. So the hardware itself apparently is long-lived also.
As we wrap up, I want to ask you, Dave, what's different from one auto show to the next? You mentioned that Dallas doesn't necessarily have a lot of concept cars. Is it pretty much the same show everywhere?
It is in markets of the same size.
Uh-huh.
You've got your three or four principal shows throughout the country, Detroit, Chicago, New York, and L.A., that generate most of the press because there is most of the new there.
Mm-hmm.
This Dallas Auto Show is very, very interesting. There is not much in the way of new news, although Dodge did make a new product announcement right here in Dallas because it's a good truck environment for Texas.
Sure.
But it is always evolving, and there's always a lot to take note of if you want to look at it closely. And again, the best way to comparison shop, even if you're a full year out from making a decision.
Are there a lot of good little bits of swag this year?
It wasn't there for the public days,
mm-hmm.
but the information is good.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some accessory people and that sort of thing lined up also. So I suspect you can find it if you go looking for it.
Last thing I want to ask you in the last 20 seconds or so, any color trends like in you know, the finish of cars?
Well, I would argue after several years of silvers, whites, which remain very, very popular,
yeah.
But yeah, color. Ford has a C-Max that is kind of this copperish orange, and you can see it from a mile away. And that's not a bad thing.
Cool. It certainly makes it safe, I guess.
You bet.
David Bolt is an automotive journalist. He writes for Autotrader.com and KBB.com. The 2011 Dallas Auto Show opens today, continues through this weekend at the Convention Center. David, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you again, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis, an engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.